This is The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. We're live tweeting the show at KUOW. Have you ever been walking through the woods and heard a sound you didn't recognize? It's not quite human, but it's close. Could that be? I mean, I'm alone. I'm getting nervous. Could that be the hairy, upright, walking, almost ape-like creature said to roam the North American wilderness? No! No, Sasquatch isn't real. Or could it be? What if we took a curious approach to that question? My next guests have a scientific approach. They've both written field guides for the citizen scientist looking to collect evidence of Bigfoot's existence. Jeff Meldrum, professor of anatomy and anthropology from Idaho State University. Welcome, professor.
Thank you.
That's Jeff, and David George Gordon is in the studio with me, a science communicator, the author of the Sasquatch Seekers Field Manual. Hi, David.
Hey, it's good to be here.
And you two, David and Jeff, have met, but not like this. You've talked online.
Only through cyberspace.
Yes.
That's right. That's right.
So first, and it's going to get more interesting, but first, in one word, yes, no, or maybe, is Sasquatch real? David.
I'm going to go with a maybe.
Maybe. Jeff?
I'm quite convinced that it is, yes.
Okay. A yes and a maybe. And in any case, we're going to approach it with curiosity and a scientific mindset. Jeff, you said probably yes. What evidence do you have of Sasquatch's existence?
Well, evidence comes in a variety of different forms. My particular expertise, what actually drew me into the pursuit of this question, was the footprint evidence. That's how I spend much of my time, is studying the evolution of human bipedalism. And so the prospect of another bipedal primate out there leaving a trace record of footprints has been a very, very intriguing one for me.
David, you are more skeptical, not as skeptical as I am, but more so. What do you say about
evidence? I actually mentioned in my book that I'm a fence sitter. I say, there's something out there. I don't want to say it doesn't exist. Someone could find one tomorrow and I'd be wrong. But I also don't want to go to court with the evidence we've gathered, because a lot of it has holes in it.
So it's almost a philosophical approach to what it means to say yes or no. Obviously, something could exist.
Yeah. And, you know, my contention is we need more evidence. I mean, the footprints, those are pretty convincing, but about at least a half of them have been ruled out as obvious fakes, including the one that spawned the name Bigfoot.
That's an obvious fake?
There was a deathbed confession on that one.
Jeff, do you believe that? Obvious fakes?
No, I'm afraid I have to disagree with David. He has a few of his facts a little misconstrued, I'm afraid. And a bit of hyperbole. I have over 300 footprint casts in my laboratory here, and if I was pressed to come up with a statistic, I would say less than 5% of them are obvious hoaxes. A few more may be somewhat ambiguous or questionable due to the lack of clarity or insufficient documentation. But the footprint evidence is extremely compelling. And the example that David points out is one that has gotten far too much mileage for the lack of substance that's there. A gentleman's family claims that he faked a bunch of footprints and trod out a couple of extremely crude carved wooden feet and assert that all the footprints that have been found in North America are attributable to the Wallace clan.
What about that, David? You said yourself that some fakes don't mean all fakes, so why the big skepticism when Jeff is saying he's got some footprints worth looking at?
Well, again, I have seen ones that have what are called dermal ridges or equivalent of fingerprints on the foot. I've seen ones that show really great sophisticated degrees of flexion that you could not fake by carving something out of plywood, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So there's something out there for sure. In fact, I hear what I really put more stock on is the eyewitness testimony. And quite frankly, there's not a real lot of percentage in telling stories when you've got nothing to gain. You're not trying to get on TV or sell a best-selling book, but you actually stand a lot to lose in terms of ridicule and things like that. So I take those seriously.
Interesting. I would have thought that a eyewitness account without any physical evidence is easier to discount. Sure, people say a lot of things.
Well, I kind of agree with you on that, but I also know a lot of people who have these sightings are experienced outdoors people or hunters are not likely to mistake this thing that they saw for a bear or an elk or some other large mammal.
Have you found that, Jeff? Reliable
right on,
people?
Yes, I would echo that. That, you know, when the category of eyewitness is a very broad one, and it includes people who are overly enthusiastic and may overinterpret what they've seen. They may see what they want to see, but then there's a significant fraction, as David points out, that are objective, level-headed professionals who spend their lives in or a large part of it in the out of doors, and they know the difference between a moose or a bear and an upright bipedal hominoid that defies attribution to any common form of wildlife.
David, what are common kinds of stories people tell you about encountering Sasquatch?
You know, I just want to build a little bit on this. I give talks through Humanities Washington on this topic.
Yes.
And oftentimes there are like four or five people in the audience who have first-person experiences. Now, some of those people you can tell, gee, they've told this story before. It's become their family thing. And I kind of question those. But on the other hand, there are people who are like, I've never really spoken about this before. It's like I've created a safe environment, like an AA meeting or something. And the people who do tell these stories, they have some recurring themes. Oftentimes they have rocks thrown at them, but not rocks that are thrown in a way that would hit them, because you'd certainly think a Sasquatch could do that, but just sort of as warning shots, if you will.
They see the beast throwing rocks at them?
Or they see a rock that landed in an area where there were no people to be throwing them.
I see.
So that's a common theme. A lot of them are, I was driving late at night. I went around a bend. They're like instant recognitions. Mm-hmm. Although I got to say, it's amazing how much you can take in a 3-second glance from a speeding car. You would definitely know what you were seeing from that.
Is there an emotional theme to the stories people tell you?
Well, I also hear a lot of stories, kind of surprising to me, that are like the Sasquatch as a mind reader or an empath, if you will. You know, people say, I was sitting in the back of my pickup truck and I was really sad because my mom had just passed away. I was out in the woods and then this thing came out of the woods. I've heard that on several occasions. So it's almost like they are responding to this call for help.
What about you, Jeff? Are there emotional themes in what people tell you about Bigfoot?
Well, it often is a very life-changing experience, and I think it shocks people, the realization that there really could be things out here that they've been told don't exist. There is this, as David alludes to, this paranormal dimension that many, many people have gotten kind of caught up in. I think some of that comes from their own lack of ability to come to an objective position where they understand since we're talking about citizen scientists, a scientific context for the possible existence of such a creature. And so they resort to other forms of explanation. I know, a lot of people have shared such subjective experiences with me. I've not shared them with them in the field. They seem to be to vanish when I'm on the scene. So that's an area, unfortunately, I think is more distraction than helpful in this situation.
Well, what's wrong with me that emotional component, while I find it lovely in the bigger picture, it makes me more skeptical about Bigfoot stories because, we're not objective. We're humans. That's okay, but there's no Bigfoot.
You know, I really believe we just need more and better quality evidence. That's where the citizen science comes in. Getting people who are actually trained, let's say they went to a weekend retreat in data gathering and collection, and then they can hand that over to people like Jeff Meldrum and actually have that analyzed rather than all these people who are out there kind of with half-baked assertions and not knowing what to do with them.
Okay, well, then let's talk about data collection. Again, that was David George Gordon, a science communicator, author of the Sasquatch Seeker's Field Manual. And we have Jeff Deldrum, a professor of anatomy and anthropology from Idaho State University. And Jeff is more inclined to think that there is Bigfoot, Sasquatch, or something like it. I want to, whether I believe or don't, I'm curious and I want to collect data one way or the other. What would I, let's start with you, David, what could I, people listening to you, do out in the wild?
Well, first thing is be prepared to write things down. You know, if you have a, if you're in an automobile accident, your insurance company says, as soon as it's safe, write down all the details.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I would say the same thing. You're not going to reach for your pad when you're staring at this 10-foot tall creature in the middle of nowhere. But as soon as you have a moment to breathe, I would definitely start writing that down.
That starts with me bringing a pad because I've got my headlamps, I've got my propane. I don't usually bring a pad.
Yeah, that's right. People have kind of lost the ability to write these days, which is unfortunate. A lot of what we know about the Northwest comes from like the logs or journals of naturalists from way back when. Lewis and Clark tell us a lot. Those guys did not have all these distractions that we have. They're not working on their smartphone at the same time. And getting that detail is really important because the thing that's funny, as you tell the story, the more you tell it, certain things become exaggerated. It's like that fish story. How big was it? You know,
uh-huh.
And the more you tell that story, the bigger those things get. And some other things really important. Well, did you hear any other noises? Was it silent? What was the weather like? A lot of that kind of those details drop out. So really writing all of that down is number one on my book.
Why does it matter what the weather was like?
There might be able, you know, over time, we might be able to see trends. It, you know, a lot of those sightings happen, for example, during a foggy day. I'm just throwing that out there. I don't know because I haven't really analyzed.
And what do you know? The sightings are on foggy days and Bigfoot is blurry. Maybe there's a connection.
Well, whatever. We can see trends from that. And, you know, with there are thousands of eyewitness reports. And actually, from my giving these talks and realizing how few people actually fill out reports and file them on the Bigfoot Research Organization's website or what have you, that's, a you know, the tip of the iceberg, actually. But how much of that detail is actually captured and shared, that's another story.
Mm-hmm. Jeff, what else about how we can contribute to this this question, this mystery?
Right. Oh, and I would just add in follow-up, too, even though people may not be inclined to grab a notepad and a pen and take along with, you know, David mentioned the smartphone. There are very few people out there now that don't have a smartphone in their back pocket. You just have to hit the record button, and you can narrate your experience and log the details down and be that much more certain to get some of those details recorded.
That's true. I have a zipper pocket in my backpack for the smartphone, which is useless when there's no service in the wild, except, I could do a voice memo. Right. I can type on that thing. Keep
it around. I'm reaching for my little notepad, waterproof notepad.
He's holding it up. Wait a minute. Can I see that?
Can I see that?
It has a picture of, it says coffee for Sasquatch, and it has a picture for Sasquatch. Why coffee for Sasquatch?
That's a shop in Los Angeles.
Ah, got it.
Just had to save that.
And it's a waterproof notebook. Very nice. It's very small. That goes in a breast pocket.
That's right. It has a sticker from a florist shop in Italy, too.
I see that. Yes, Jeff?
Well, one of the points that is important to bear in mind that I remind people of is that if indeed these creatures exist, I'm quite convinced that they're extremely rare. It's a very dispersed population. It doesn't need a lot of individuals to sustain it because of various inferences we can draw about their natural history. Since they, if they exist, they're large hominoids. So that means they're long-lived. They have no, given their size, no natural predators, etc. There just doesn't have to be very many. And given what seems to be solitary behavior and far-ranging home ranges, large home ranges, the opportunity to encounter Sasquatch is very serendipitous in many ways. So I tell people to become familiar with the areas that they frequent. Learn about the natural history. Learn about the geology, the forest types, the plants, where the cover and the food are. Learn more about the behavior of the other wildlife that's there. So you have a context while you're out there searching and looking, and above all, enjoy the time that you spend out there, because chances are you're not going to have an encounter. You're not going to experience quote-unquote Sasquatch activity every weekend that you go out into the field.
When you say there may just not be very many, Jeff, how many are you thinking? How many Sasquatches do you think there are?
Well, if I had to put a number in, say, in North America, I would say it would be under under 2,000.
Under 2,000.
Yeah.
Wouldn't we at least find? I know that Sasquatches, they run away and all that. They're elusive. But what about just finding dead Sasquatches? If they're thousands, well, eventually we'd come across one.
Well, let's put that in context. Here, I'm from Idaho, and so if I sort of crunch the numbers without belaboring with you here how I arrive at that formulation, but I would estimate of those 2,000, there's about 100 to 150 Sasquatch in Idaho, just as a working number. By comparison, there's 25 to 30,000 black bear in Idaho. And yet, if you started talking to outdoorsmen, how many outdoorsmen have bumped into a carcass of a bear?
Yeah, good point.
In the wild? So when you start thinking about the implications of those numbers as far as the accumulation of data, the chances of encountering a Sasquatch or finding trace evidence of it, then you start to really appreciate how rare an event this is. And so as a scientist, that's a little bit frustrating and discouraging because it means I can't go out in the field and consistently, in a systematic way, collect data about Sasquatch. And so I'm very beholden to, I rely upon those quote-unquote amateurs, or those, better yet, those citizen scientists who have trained themselves, who have developed some skills in the field, to collect and document and discriminate and identify and report that data to me.
Jeff Meldrum, professor of anatomy and anthropology from Idaho State University, on the phone with us. David George Gordon is in the studio, author of the Sasquatch Seeker's Field Manual. And David, you're going to be giving a talk about cryptids and Sasquatch on July 28th in Moses Lake.
There's a wonderful exhibit of Sasquatch abelia at the Moses Lake Museum and Art Center. Just opened quite recently.
All right.
I understand Jeff Meldrum is speaking there as well.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
July 28th.
In August.
And that's in August.
I'll be there in August.
Good. And also, David, you're August 8th. You're at the San Juan Library, and you're just around Washington this fall with Humanities Washington.
I would say go to the Humanities Washington website. They actually got so many requests for my talk that they kind of turned off the tap.
And, believe it.
Now people are basically forking over their own cash to get me out there.
And you heard them for free on KOAW. David and Jeff, thanks very much to both of you.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
And thank you for tuning into The Record, produced by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jima Brempong, Allison Bruzek, Lars, Matt Martin, Jason Pagano, social media producer Bree Ripley. I'm Bill Radke. See us live tomorrow night. We're talking Joni Balter, Chris Vance, Nikita Oliver, reviewing the week's news on stage with you at the McMenamins Anderson School in Bothell. Doors open for you at 6 p.m. Tickets are free. Just go reserve your seat at kuow.org/engage, and we'll see you tomorrow night.